Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 131 of the podcast, everybody, with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Hopefully a fun one this week, Andrew, because we're delving into the curious world of Citroën.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit different, isn't it?
It is different, and what I kind of hope is that people don't think, oh, Citroën, they're going to be talking about, you know, C3s and C4s and immediately tune out. We're not going to be doing that.
No.
You know, to me, well, I own a Citroën, so maybe I would say this, but it's just a fascinating brand. It's just, and they have done so much cool stuff in their time. And we don't, I don't think, spend enough time on here, well, apart from your bloody Alpine, celebrating cool French cars. So for 1 week only, that's what we're going to do.
And we're just going to,
you know, because you've been over in France, haven't you, driving a load of them. So we want to hear about that. And I'm going to blather on a bit about why I think they're just really cool.
Yeah, there's lots to say. Before we do that, I just want to play you a very short clip from your most recent Last Blast podcast with Dr. Jonathan Palmer. So that podcast is available now to TI app and website subscribers. Let me just play a very short clip for you now.
I love the Honda NSX.
Yeah.
For all sorts of reasons. I loved the boldness of Honda. I had huge admiration, and still do, with Honda for engineering excellence. But here was Honda's first attempt to rival Ferrari, who at the time probably had the 308 or 328 or something. You might have a better memory.
It was a 348. It was a 348. Terrible car.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here Honda had come along and produced a car that was so much superior to the Ferrari.
Yeah.
With their first attempt.
Yes.
And not only was it was the driving experience superior, but the engineering was so much superior. The engine was, it wasn't, I think it's 276 horsepower from memory, but it sung round to about 8,000 revs. It had the VTEC, so you know, you had that sort of intake deepening.
It was great.
Sort of 6,500. But, you know, as a fully sort of harmonized car between engine sweetness, lovely gearbox, good grip, supple chassis, brakes, it all worked as a package together beautifully. It was a much more of a pleasure to drive from the McLaren F1. I'd often go back to God and say, look, you know, we're miles away still. You know, the ride handling of the and the stability of the NSX was, frankly, it was always vastly better than the McLaren F1.
The Last Blast podcast is sponsored by Footman James, a car insurance company unlike any other. Footman James exists right at the heart of the car enthusiast scene in the UK, holding regular car meets, publishing reports into the health of the classic car scene in this country. And yes, sponsoring the best car podcast out there. Thank you, Footman James. To find out more, visit footmanjames.co.uk. There aren't too many people who are qualified to compare the Honda NSX to the McLaren F1.
Yeah.
He's one of them.
And also, you know, he was the bloke who developed the McLaren F1.
Yeah.
And he's been quite critical of it, isn't he?
Mm.
And the way it was set up and everything else. He is like, you know, a few of his contemporaries, he's just such a, you know, obviously, you know, to go racing Formula One cars in the era that he was in sports cars, you had to be, you know, a, you know, brave and talented. That kind of went without saying. But he's just such a clear thinker. And he's so erudite. He puts his points so well. Whether you agree with him or not, it's really neither here nor there. It's just really interesting to hear what he has to say. And obviously, you know, he's gone and had, well, he had this other career before he was a racing driver, and then he's gone on to have this amazing career in motorsport business after his career as a driver came to an end. He's a really important figure. I mean, if you've been to, goodness, Snett, Brands, Donington, Cadwell, Alton, and many other places, like Bedford, and others I've doubtless forgotten, you know, they're all his places. You know, he runs most of the big circuits in the UK. And, yeah, I mean, he's just a really, really interesting and engaging bloke to sit down and talk to.
Yeah, he really is. Also, properly knowledgeable about road cars. Sometimes you just want...
Oh, he loves them.
He loves them, and he remembers, yeah, you know, power outputs from 30 years ago and cylinder counts,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and displacement, everything.
I mean, I can remember more than 30 years ago when I was the road test editor of Autocar. He used to ring me up and just go, have you driven the such and such? Or will you be testing, yeah, the such and such? Or I'd have written something, and he'd go, you said this about that. I just driven it, and I don't understand. And he was just ringing up as an enthusiast to talk about road cars. He loves all that stuff. Actually, when they launched the, not the GT3 RS, which we talked about last week, but the GT3, there's a current version of the GT3. And they had a car at the Bedford Autodrome, which I was skidding about in. And he turned up, and he was just going, sort of, give us a go. And I was going, well, it's not my car. You need to talk to the Porsche guys. And the Porsche guys went, yeah, well, fine. It's kind of like your track. We don't really have much of a choice. And he got in this thing. Jonathan's, what, 65 now? And he drove this thing like a bullet. And he was skidding around and thing, having a whale of a time. And he came back, and he was just like a little boy. He just thought it was incredible. He'd had so much fun. And all the enthusiasm. You know, we think of Jonathan quite often as a sort of fairly hard-nosed businessman.
Yeah.
But actually, there's just a petrol head under there. He just loves it. And that's why he's such a good interview, because, you know, there's the brain, and then there's the skill, and there's the courage. But more than anything else, there's just the enthusiasm. He's just like you and me, and everybody listening to this. He just loves cars. All cars, all kinds of cars, road cars, racing cars, the lot.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wasn't expecting that at all, because he these days comes with a reputation, as you suggest, and actually he just seems like a proper car guy. So, as you say,
no,
brilliant
is.
Interview.
Any question.
Yeah, it's on the TI app and website, the-intercooler.com, right now. Okay, but Citroën, right? And
yeah.
I wanted to discuss Citroën because I think, for me, you know, if we think about the cars they've been producing in the last 20, 25 years when I've been aware of them, I mean, there's been some curios in there, but I think I've sort of known Citroën as a manufacturer of little hatchbacks, mid-sized hatchbacks, maybe medium-sized people carriers like the Zara Picasso.
Yeah.
And there's not been an awful lot in there to really excite a car enthusiast, particularly someone who leans towards the performance side of motoring.
Okay, but even as, you know, just a person who's interested in cars, not necessarily high speed. I mean, can you remember driving any that you thought, okay, this may not be particularly fast or particularly for enthusiasm, but it's just really good at the job it's designed to do?
I'm sure I have done, but I don't remember it. I don't think I've ever had a really enlightening experience in one.
Some of the MPVs, which, you know, MPVs are pretty out of fashion these days, aren't they? Things like a C4 Picasso, you know, they're actually pretty fit for purpose. But so many of them have just been, it's almost like they care so little about the driver that they've almost gone out of their way to make sure that the cars are just, you know, have nothing of any interest for them there. And it's, And it's a shame. And then they did this DS offshoot brand, which I guess they would claim as a kind of like a separate company, in the same way that, you know, Lexus is a separate company to Toyota. And none of those, well, certainly none that I've driven, apart from, what was it, the DS3 Racing? Remember that?
Mm. Yeah.
The thing which had writing on it. none of those was remotely interesting to drive. And the thing about Citroën, and the reason I make this point now, is there are going to be so many Citroëns, which we'll talk about in the next however long, which aren't fast, aren't thought of as being sports cars, but they're still so great to drive. They're such a cool... I mean, I've got one in my shed. Every time I get out there, I just know I'm going to have a fantastic experience. And you will find, you know, people who really, really, really know their stuff about cars, who will just rave about Citroëns because, well, certain sorts of Citroëns, because they're just, they just prove you don't need to be screaming around the place at a million miles an hour or, you know, pulling your head off with all the G-force in the corners. Mm. You just need a car that's interesting. And goodness me, they've made some interesting cars.
So this is exactly it, right? There's, as long as I've been writing about cars, there's been this kind of disconnect between the Citroëns I have known and the reputation of the mark that I have been well aware of. And all the oddball and, you know, curious cars that they've manufactured over the years. So I was delighted to have been invited to go to the Citroën Conservatoire in Paris, which is, it's a heritage collection, really. Because this was an opportunity.
Is it a big glass building?
It's not. It doesn't mean conservatory in that sense. I think it means conservation, which makes sense.
I'm showing my ignorance here.
It was a big warehouse, a very unattractive warehouse. But here was an opportunity to forget everything that I knew about modern day Citroën and really get beneath the skin, the history, the heritage of this brand. And educate myself, actually. And I'm so, so glad that I got to do that because I learned a lot.
Is it not quite a brave thing to do, to get a bunch of journalists, invite them over, they get here and go, look at all these cars with a kind of charm and an interest of a kind we don't make anymore? Is there not a sort of slightly unflattering compare and contrast to the modern day Citroëns going on here?
Well, this is why some manufacturers are getting rid of heritage fleets, isn't it? Particularly as we move towards a different age. Some think it's unhelpful. Others think it's essential to remember where you've come from. I suppose you can
spin
it either way.
Here are a bunch of cars which are all much better than the ones we make today.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. So let's go all the way to the back, to the beginning. Citroën was founded by André... It's not Citroën, is it? Is it Citroën?
Citroën. I've already proven in the course of the problem, I don't even know what the word conservatoire means, so you're not going to get me on French, I'm afraid.
Pronunciations. So, founded in 1919. Now, he originally manufactured gears, specifically herringbone gears, gears that come together like that. And if you're watching this, you can see what I'm doing. And that, of course, is where the double chevron Citroën logo comes from.
I never knew that.
Yeah. And
is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, there you go.
And if you, when you walk into the Conservatoire, which, by the way, is at the old Orly plant, which is near Charles de Gaulle, and this was an old Citroën plant, which is now, it is no longer, it's a...
Conservatoire.
It's a big logistics distribution hub, so it's very unsexy now. But there is, on the site, is the Conservatoire, which is just a very unassuming, very anonymous... industrial unit. It's a big warehouse, really. But you walk in, and the first thing you see is one of the very earliest Citroëns, and behind it, in the corner, one of André Citroën's desks, one of his original desks that he would work at when he was at the plant. And so they start right at the beginning. And the first half dozen, maybe 10 or so cars, are 1920s machines. And they...
I know nothing about those.
No, nothing at all. And to me, they look like Model T Fords, really. For cars from that era of this type, all look kind of the same. They were very upright, weren't they? Very sit up and leg. And what distinguishes Citroëns from others is the grille design, really. That's about it. But it's when you get into the 30s, and actually, it's when you get to the Traction Avant. in 1934, that changes. And cars in that era, they weren't taller than you or I anymore. They lost a foot and a half in height, and they sat much lower to the ground. And the clever thing about this car, and traction avant literally means front traction. It wasn't the first front-wheel drive car by any means, but it was an early one. And it also had independent suspension. It had rack and pinion steering. It had brakes on all four corners, I believe. And it also had a monocoque
body. Brakes on all four corners, and it's one of those things that, you know, I was reading up about it, and they were saying that they pioneered these technologies. They didn't at all. You know, Lancia had monocoque construction, independent suspension, in the 1920s. But, you know, but Lancias of that era were extremely expensive. And what Citroën did was they democratized all that, and they put them together in one car. So you had a car with independent suspension all round. You had a car with front-wheel drive. Now, Alvis were making front-wheel drive cars in the 1920s. And you had a car, a monocoque front-wheel drive and independent suspension. And I suspect it probably was the first car to have all of those things. And then, you know, put them on a road at a price that, I mean, they weren't sort of budget cars by any means, but they were eminently affordable machines. And that was extraordinary, because even if you look at what the big grand brands of the day were doing, you know, think of something like Rolls Royce, weren't doing anything like that. You know, you bought a 1934 Rolls Royce, it wouldn't have independent suspension, it wouldn't have unitary construction. It was a body bolted to a chassis. It was very much the technology of the 20s and earlier, and then Citroën came along and did all this. And also, such a cool-looking car. Just such a great-looking car. And it's exactly what you were saying about design. That sort of sit-up-and-beg look of the 1920s had gone, and you had this rather sort of rakish, swoopy shape, which is also, at the same time, somehow so very French.
But you imagine how modern that must have looked when it appeared in 1934.
Unbelievable. Must look like a spaceship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Did you drive one?
very, very briefly, yeah. So I remember very heavy steering, very little performance, of course.
Yeah.
Most of all, I remember the very curious gear shift. Now, I'll come on to gear shift a bit later on, because there's a funny sort of story to be told through the decades with Citroën gear shifts. The point about that car is that right from the 1930s, Citroën was innovating, perhaps not technologies, but how they were deployed. And innovation is a key part of the Citroën tale, isn't it?
It is the Citroën tale, to me. It is what Citroën is about. It is about innovation.
And very soon and after the traction.
Sorry.
No, go on, carry on.
Well, also particularly getting innovations. It's always this thing, isn't it? You know, technology is... Inventions are useless if you don't get them to a market at a price, you know, that can be afforded, so people can actually enjoy them. If you invent some incredible technology, but no one can afford it, no one gets to use it, it's meaningless.
Yeah,
and what Citroën did is that they took this stuff, you know, most of which had been done before, but suddenly they gave it to everybody. And so everybody derived the benefits from it. And that was, to me, that was what was so fantastic about all the stuff they were doing, both before and soon after the war as well.
So very soon after the traction avant, another car emerged from Citroën. Innovative little thing. So tell us about the 2CV and why it's significant. And if you must, tell us about yours.
I could do an entire podcast on this very easily. Actually, it's just the same stuff that we've been talking about. It's just innovation. It's innovation. It's really clearly thought out design. And it was Citroën's ability to bring it to the masses. That was the thing. The 2CV was designed before the war, basically went into production soon thereafter. And it was basically, a farmer's car. That's what it was. They wanted an incredibly simple, very rugged you know, capacious thing, device, which would allow farmers to roam around their grounds, picking up stuff, and, you know, chuntering off to market or whatever with it. And that's what, that's what it was designed to do. And there's that famous thing, isn't it, about you had to be able to drive across a ploughed field with a basket of eggs on the passenger seat and none of them break. And so to do that, they developed this, again, very simple but very clever, fully independent, interconnected front to rear suspension system, which versions of stayed on all two CVs until the last one was built, I think, in 1990. So, you know, the car was in production for, you know, 40-odd years. And so that's what that's what they came into existence to do. But, of course, you know, like so many cars, like the Mini, if you like, you know, the Mini was conceived as a cheap family hold-on, and then it just went on to be, you know, a movie star and a rally car and all and a fashion icon and all these other things. And the 2CV was the same. It just suddenly became this incredibly iconoclastic but effective, cheap, fun car. And that's the thing that people who don't drive 2CVs, haven't driven 2CVs, really struggle with, because they see this. Jasper Carrot once described a 2CV as an upturned corrugated pram on wheels, and he's not far wrong. And they see these things, and they see that they have 602cc engines, not realising actually that's the biggest engine that they ever put in a 2CV. They did smaller ones as well, including the one in my car. And they think, well, how could that possibly be fun? It just looks ridiculous. It looks like a sort of noddy car. And all I can say is just drive one. And if you are a proper enthusiast, if you're a proper petrol head, and you understand the difference between fast and fun, and you understand what, you know, what feel and just properly conceived and well-engineered cars should be like, you can't not enjoy a 2CV. You just can't not. And, you know, so mine's a 1958 car. So pretty early, but not, you know, one of the earliest. I mean, there are very, very few around because they all got treated terribly and fell to pieces and that sort of thing. So mine's a survivor. 425cc engine, should have 12 horsepower. I've got the original engine for it, which came with the car. I've actually put an engine from a later 2CV van in it, which is, I'm so proud of this. It's meant to have 17 horsepower. and actually, the difference that makes is the difference between it actually being a pain in the bum and not, because, you know, with a 12 horsepower engine, it couldn't even keep up with the traffic. And I hate driving along, looking in the mirror and just seeing a queue of pissed off people behind me. I just can't do it. It's just not in my makeup to be all right with that. And with the later engine, that doesn't happen. Because I can beetle about 50 miles an hour, and on the country lanes around here, that's probably as fast as anybody else is going to be going. So it's fine. And it is just an unending joy. I think I've said on this podcast before, it is not possible to be unhappy and at the wheel of that car at the same time. You just can't. You just get in it, and it's so much fun. And it makes, I mean, one of the best drives I've ever had in anything was Chris Harris and I, because he has an almost identical car. He's 1 year older than mine. Which he never lets me forget, but it's also an awful lot scruffier than mine. There's a video of us racing ours across a field on YouTube, if you just care to go and put Harris 2CV into a search engine, you'll have a look at it. But we once decided we were going to take our cars to the pub, and the pub was about 6 miles away. And we didn't intend to set off together, but, you know, we live very close to each other, and we met each other up on the road, and a race ensued. And I can say that because not once did we ever come anywhere near breaking a speed limit. Nowhere, not even close. So I can say, and, you know, ask Chris, ask me, it was one of the funniest things. It was one of the most memorable, fun things I have ever done in a car. I've driven cars with 1,000 horsepower. I've enjoyed less than that drive. And the whole thing probably took, I don't know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You know, you don't have to be driving across America or, you know, up a mountain or anything. You just need a 2CV and a like-minded mate. And it was, yeah, I mean, I'll never, ever forget it. I can remember when it was done, we couldn't get up. We just sat in the cars laughing. And he rang me up the following morning, and I just, I can't talk to you. I'm still laughing. It was, so there is something about those cars. And it's not just the fact that they're old and quaint and curious. It's actually, they are just, they're just incredibly well engineered. There's that independent suspension. That flat two engine means that, just contrary to appearance, their center of gravity is right down on the deck. And I'll tell you something else about them. They're amazing off-roaders, because although they're only front-wheel drive cars, they've got these really, really skinny tyres. They weigh nothing. And when we did that race across the field, what you couldn't see, there was a steep, muddy hill. We had to get up and down to get into and out of the field. And I was saying to Chris, well, it's fine. Like, we'll get them in. We'll slither down the hill, but we'll never get them out of the field. We'll have to get them towed out. They're going, no, it'll be fine. And honestly, it went up. Both cars went up that like a Land Rover. It was just, I mean, where they got the grip from, I have no idea. I mean, he was saying it's because ours are early cars and they have universal joints instead of constant velocity joints in their front suspension. And he says that kind of that's almost the same as having a lock diff in them, which may or may not be true. But they're just amazing things. I've gone on far too long about these things. Before I had got the one I had now, I used to, you know, when I was young and I couldn't afford anything else, that's what I had. I just had an endless string of 2CVs, and I used to do terrible things. Don't anyone try this in one. But when I was, 18, 19, I used to slipstream National Express coaches going up motorways. And because they created such a hole in the wall, and because 2CVs have a pretty good shape for this sort of thing, you could almost take your foot off the accelerator and you'd be dragged up the M1 at 70 miles an hour by one of these things. I left my wedding in one. Because I just thought, what better thing? My wedding cake was in the shape of a 2CV. I sound like an obsessive now, aren't I? I'll shut up. But I just...
Brilliant.
I just love them.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of gear shift, manual gear shift, does your car have?
Standard push-me-pull-you, hockey stick, four-speed, manual gearbox.
Is it that plunger that goes into the dash and you do weird things with it? Or more like a standard manual?
It's a plunger that goes into the dash. You do weird things. Yeah. The thing is, because I've been doing this since I've been able to drive, it's not weird to me at all. I literally don't think about it.
To me, it was extremely bizarre, but I'll come on to that again a little bit later on. The Citroën Conservatoire, it's been where it is for around 20 years, but the collection is older than that. And it's an independent, not-for-profit organisation separate to Citroën and totally separate to Stellantis and the whole group. The collection existed, but it was separated from PSA, as it was, when the company was either made public or when the French government bought a sizable stake in the company, because... You know, you've got actually a very valuable collection of cars, and in a public company, you know, anything with value is at risk, isn't it? It could just be sold off. The sort of romance and the charm of holding onto these cars is lost on a sort of faceless organisation.
Well, sacrifice on the altar of shareholder value, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So, they were very cleverly separated.
Producing a return for their shareholders, if not, get rid of them.
Mm. Yeah,
there's no long-term strategic thinking about these are actually, you know, building the brand, and you know they may not provide any income, but you know, but they're appreciating assets and all that sort of stuff. It's, you know, they don't think that way, do they?
No. So wisely, they were separated. Otherwise, who knows? They might not still be there these days. And I think the collection is 500 or 600 cars at the Conservatoire. There's around 300, almost 300. Mostly, almost all of them Citroëns and DSs. And they are sorted by decade. So after the 2CV, you move into the 50s. And actually, adjacent to the 2CV corner of the Conservatoire, what you have is a lineup of motorsport cars. Actually, before it's the motorsport cars, it's the sort of off-road rally adventure cars. You know, they built a load of DSs and even SMs to do these. They are rallies, not rallies as we know them today, you know, sprint rallies, but epic drives through North Africa and through the Asian continent and through South America.
And DSs won a lot of rallies, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an important part of the company's heritage. And then adjacent to these adventure rally cars, we'll call them, you've got the Dakar machines. And then they bleed into the WRC machines. And of course, actually, you know, if you ask me about Citroën today, I will say Sebastian Loeb, Zara WRC, C4 WRC, DS3 WRC. You know, in my era, that's what I know Citroën for, winning countless back-to-back championships, winning all those rallies.
Yeah.
And at the far end of the conservatoire, all those cars are lined up.
Do you think that all that actually, because to me there's such a disconnect. You know, I can see, you know, Audi doing Le Mans and Audi selling more Audi TTs or R8s or even RS6s or even, you know, normal Audis as a result of that. Because, you know, it might be a slightly tennis connection, but I can sort of see the link. Obviously, I can see, you know, when Porsche and Ferrari and Aston Martin and other, you know, performance brands do that, then obviously there's a very clear read. But do you actually think that, you know, Loeb winning rallies in Zara and C4s and DS and that sort of, do you think that actually sold more Citroën Zara Picassos?
I don't think that.
What was he doing there? I mean, that's clearly the purpose, isn't it? But I've just never understood that. It's like, you know, Peugeot are back in the WEC now, aren't they? Which is, you know, fantastic. You know, good luck to them and everything else. But are they really going to sell more 508s as a result of that? I don't know. I mean, clearly they think they will, because they wouldn't be doing it if they didn't.
Yeah, maybe it's not directly about selling more cars, but more about building brand. And, you know, for someone of my age, it might well be that the only interesting thing about Citroën back, you know, 10, 20 years ago was that they were winning rallies.
Well, apart from the Berlingo, but that's about it.
Well, okay, fine. Berlingo, fair enough.
Cracking van, yeah. But anyway, sorry, I digress. But yeah, you know, fine. Yeah, very. So that makes Citroën to you as a brand. It's interesting that it's winning rallies. But do you think it would have made you 1% more likely to put your hand in your pocket and actually go out and buy one? If the brand you're building is not relevant to the cars you're making. I'm not saying this is wrong. All I'm saying is I don't understand it, and I never have.
Mm.
I've never understood it.
The Citroën always
the people
said
who buy Citroëns can't. Citroën's typical customer. I just don't believe that they sit there on a Sunday afternoon watching rallying. I just don't, or you know, or reading about it. I just don't think that they do. And, you know, does it mean that in 20 years' time, because they're rallying now, that means that somehow people are going to be buying more Citroëns then? Because I don't see that either. I just, you know, unless what you're doing for promotion and marketing is relevant to the product that you sell, I don't understand why people do it. But they do, so there must be a point. I'm just, you know, I'm probably being thick and missing something.
I think Citroën, back in the day, justified it, perhaps not publicly, but what I've since heard is that they wanted to address this reputation for building flaky, fragile cars and demonstrating that they can win at the highest level of the most grueling, arguably, form of motorsport there is, shows that they can build tough cars. Now, you and I know that the cars Loeb was driving bear no relation whatsoever to the ones in the showroom, but others, on an almost subconscious level, people might be left with an impression that, oh, a Citroën might be a tough kind of car. What they always said about building a road-going equivalent of one of Loeb's WRC machines. And don't forget, you know, Mitsubishi did so. Subaru did so. To some extent, Ford did so. But Citroën always said there wasn't a market for that kind of car. Just look at what Toyota did with the GR Yaris. How much hype around that car. How many orders they took for those things. I think Citroën got that wrong.
And look what's, you know, look what the Mitsubishi Evo and the Imprezas did for those brands, because they actually had the courage and the nous to think, well, we have to make the connection. So I know, let's sell them. Let's literally make the connection. And, you know, both those brands benefited massively from what they were doing in rally in a way that I just can't believe that Citroën has.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a missed opportunity, but you cannot deny that they did remarkable things in rallying.
Oh, absolutely.
And it also helped to keep alive that spirit of adventure that actually does run almost all the way through Citroën's heritage. So yeah, there's something in it. Do we want to talk about the DS? Now, sadly, I didn't get to drive a DS when I was out there. There wasn't one available, but have you driven them?
I've driven one. I've driven two, actually, but one of them was such a long time ago and I didn't drive very far, so I won't even bother with it. I've driven one. I'm going to sound like I'm damning with faint praise. I mean, they are lovely things. Incredibly innovative. You know, that, whatever they call it, oleopneumatic, hydromatic, I don't know, but the suspension, yeah, or the self-leveling suspension on them. You know, I think first production car to have disc brakes in all four corners. Early ones, the 19s, just stunningly beautiful. I mean, jaw-droppingly beautiful cars. To drive? I mean, I suspect it's one of those things that you'd need to... Actually, funny enough, I did drive one quite recently, actually. Harris turned up in a DS19 Safari, the estate. And a load of us jumped in it and, funnily enough, went to the pub. And I did drive that. And actually, in those conditions, when there are a lot of people on board and we're all larking about having a laugh, it was charming and it was very appropriate to us and the mood that we're in. And it was absolutely lovely. But because... Certainly the one that I drove the most, you know, it had that 1.9-litre four-cylinder engine, pretty undistinguished powertrain. The ride handling balance is skewed so far in the direction of ride, then they really are not very great shakes at all in the corner. I mean, they're nice cars, but they are... Oh, I'm going to use another French term now. Objet. They are more things to... I mean, I do like them, and I like them a lot, and I admire them, but not for the usual reasons. It's not because they're great driving machines. It's because I just admire the boldness behind the design, how they carried it off so well. And the innovations in the suspension and the looks and the brakes. Oh, you didn't drive one, did you? So you didn't drive one with a button brake?
No, I've drove several others with exactly that.
Oh, okay. So they don't have a brake pedal, they have a pressure pad. And that takes a bit of getting used to, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. First
time you tread on one of those. But again, it's like so many Citroën things, like your push me, pull you, gear change you were talking about. After a bit, you literally just, when you mentioned that, I was just thinking, well, what's he talking about? And I thought, oh yeah, my car's got one of those. And it's the same with those pressure pad brakes. You just, you know, and once you're used to it, you're used to it. I think the Chaperon, the convertible DS19, is one of the best looking. Presumably they have one of those there.
Yeah, sensational.
Yeah, just jaw-droppingly beautiful car. I've never driven one. I'd love to. But they're proper. They're all the money these days.
Are they?
Yeah. Properly expensive.
Our mate, Jethro Bovingdon, who is known for being a hand, a hot shoe at the wheel.
He's got one, hasn't he?
He's got a DS, and he loves his. He loves it, which is a very un-Jethro car, but, well, actually, maybe he's more broad-minded than we imagine. He'll be listening to this, so hello, Jethro. It's just curious that this is someone who loves the most sort of hardcore performance cars, but also adores his own DS.
Well, I mean, another bloke who'll be known to many people on this podcast, Richard Bremner, bloke who has been writing incredibly... eloquently and intelligently about cars for God, even longer than I have. He's got one. He might have sold it, actually. Because I think it's fair to say it wasn't the most reliable car in the world. And he once worked out, because I think he basically drove it 11 yards, it broke down, and then it didn't move again for another 10 years. And he worked it out, it cost him more than £1 million a mile to run. That's quite expensive. They are terrific things, and you know, compared to all the dull stuff that was being produced by others at the time, and there was Citroen up there just going, no, that doesn't need to be like that. They don't need to just be, you know, automotive white goods on wheels. We can create stuff that is clever and beautiful and turns every journey into an occasion. Something to be proud of, something that, you know, on a rainy Monday morning, you look out your bedroom window and you see it there and it puts a smile on your face. And that's the value of those sorts of cars. It just makes every interaction with them special. And that's why they absolutely, even though they're not the greatest things to drive, they are wonderful things to be in. And their fame and their legend is absolutely deserved.
Okay, well, let's talk about another incredible-looking Citroen. The SM, which I did get to drive. I did get to drive an SM. Now that is a remarkable car. The way it looks, the cabin, the seats,
brilliant.
The technology on it,
brilliant.
It's.
I want to hear all about it.
The SM. It's got the Maserati V6.
Well, because Citroen owned Maserati at the time.
Yeah, and when they open the bonnet and you look at it, the engine's so far away. It's so far behind the front axle line. And you also realise what a terrible mess it is under the bonnet and the wiring. And I think when these things go wrong, there's about four people on Earth who know how to fix them. So they do seem like a nightmare. But they're front-wheel drive, engine all the way back. And it was the first car that I drove. And what do you notice? So, yeah, it's got that mushroom brake pedal, which isn't a pedal, it's a button. And so the first time you squeeze it, you stand the car on its nose. But I found that actually, just with a little bit of care, you very quickly get quite used to it and you can, you know, slow the car down quite steadily. And it's this very, very curious combination of that sort of languid ride, that fluid ride that you'd expect of a Citroen of that era, but super sharp steering. I think it's two turns lock to lock or something.
Yeah.
And it's got
Heavily assisted.
And it's got this active, very sudden self-centering. And so it's a really weird rack. And the thing rolls a lot, like a Citroen should do. And so you're driving it with this super pointy steering and the thing's all over the place. You're like, crikey, what's going on here? And what's curious about the steering is that, do you know what? It feels modern by today's standards because so many cars have very quick steering. Yeah. And you just wonder, what did that feel like when the car was new? It must have been totally bizarre.
I wonder what it sounded like. Did it feel quick? Did it feel like it handled at all?
It sort of handled in that you knew it was going to roll to a certain degree, but then it would grip and just hold a line. It doesn't sound particularly alluring. You know, it's a fairly dull, flat, gruff kind of V6 sound, but it has decent performance. It does get up and go, and the engine's quite revvy. But the key thing about the SM is that, unlike almost every other Citroen, which has a wheezy little four-cylinder or a two-pot even, this has actually got some pep. It's got some get up and go.
What's it got, 200 horsepower or so?
I don't know, actually. I'd have to look that up. You know, it's not a rocket ship, but it does go. And it's just a gorgeous thing to be in. And what I was saving this chat about gear shifts, because in the SM, you've got what just feels like a modern-ish, actually with open gate, H-pattern manual. It just feels like a manual gearbox. It is. But you go all the way back to the traction avant, and it's got this sprouting out of the dashboard, like a little thumb. There's this metal lever that you move around, sort of up and down this panel in the dashboard, and none of the gears are quite where you think they should be. So you're constantly checking for the readout to figure out where to go. And then you get into the 2CV, and you've got this weird plunger that comes in and out of the dashboard. And you think, well, I'm never going to get my head around that. But of course, when you get going, actually, you just sort of do what you would do with a H-pattern manual, and you.
It's completely natural.
Yeah.
It's horrible. You know, the gear stick is horizontal rather than vertical.
Yeah.
It's got a dog leg first and a dog leg fourth, which is slightly strange. Yeah. So the only gears that are in the same plane are second and third. But actually, if you just do what seems to make sense, it makes sense, and that's what it does. You know, you're never gonna wrong slot in one of those things. You're never gonna, you know, find yourself in second rather than fourth. So relax.
So there you go from that to the SM with a fairly conventional, a very conventional manual gear shift. And so it took Citroën for several decades was toying with manual gear shifts and, you know, going through all these different different variations of it before eventually arriving at the same solution as everyone else. So that's the SM. I mean, we can't bang on about these old Citroëns for too long. And there are so many that we haven't mentioned. The GS and the CX. And the BX. And I got to drive a BX very briefly and a BX Digit, which apparently is a special one. It's got a digital dashboard.
Digit?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I'm just trying to think if I remember the BX Digit. I remember the BX19 GTI 4x4.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
And that was a hot hatch BX.
Yeah. And then, do you know what? I didn't know this about the BX, but they're super light. They're super light. They're four or five door. Are they hatchbacks?
They're hatchbacks, the 5 doors.
You know, they're good sized family cars.
Yeah.
900 kilos or something.
Really? Oh, it might be.
Well, I think the very early ones. I was amazed when I heard that. I'd need to look it up, but I think the very early ones were around that.
Are we going to get around to the AXGT at some stage?
I think we should do that now. Well, we haven't spoken about any of the tiny ones. Because
the AXGT is, I thought of it because you were talking about light Citroëns, and I just thought, well, that must be, well, two CVs and things aside, you know, of the even remotely modern era. The AXGT was probably, it certainly was the lightest hatchback of its era. It might have been the lightest hatchback of any era. I mean, it was made out of tin foil. They were so light. But, I mean, for any AX, I can remember driving a 1.1 AX, and because they are so light, they're just completely brilliant. It's almost like driving a Caterham in hot hatchback form. And an AXGT, which has that wonderful 1340 or 1360 cc engine in it, 85 horsepower, it's just all the fun in the world. I mean, you would not want to have an accident in it for anything. Probably every bit as much fun as a 1.6 205 GTI, not quite as quick, but for just hooning around in. I mean, they made such fantastic cars back then, and it's just, you know, it saddens me that, you know, all that charm, all that enthusiasm, all that just love of the drive is just gone. And they make, you know, I'm sure the cars they make today, I'm sure Citroën understands its customer very well, and they make cars which are effective. They do have slightly quirky interiors and that sort of thing, but they're just not that joy. That's the word. Just the joy of the drive. That's gone. That's sad.
We drove out there to Paris in the facelifted C5 Aircross, and it wasn't a thorough test because it's basically auto route all the way. It was comfortable, spacious, very refined, you know, good car for a long, long drive. I didn't come back wanting one. So I've just checked, by the way, and certainly an early BX was 870 kilograms.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Amazing, isn't it?
A 5-door family hatchback, 870 kilograms.
The final part of the conservatoire display, if you like, that I wanted to talk about was the row of presidential cars, including there was an SM, there was a DS, and then some modern stuff. But the point about those cars is that literally from French farming peasants to French presidents, there's a Citroën.
Yeah.
Curious, president. Isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's great, isn't it? You know, it's an everyman's kind of car, isn't it? It's just, you know, they just work.
So finally, before we stop banging on about Citroëns, you wrote on the Intercooler app and website about driving a very special Citroën.
Yes.
We have mentioned him already. Sebastian Loeb, C4 WRC. You did this in 2009.
Yes.
The man himself was there. You were on what appeared to be the proper rally stage.
Yes.
My God, what a privilege. I didn't know you'd done that. I can't tell you how jealous I am. Your story is on the Appen website now, by the way, if people want to go and read the whole thing, and you should do.
It was strange. It came out of nowhere. Just a call. They'd never let anyone drive anything like that before, let alone laid on Loeb. We went down to... Well, the stage is literally next to Paul Rickard. And, you know, Citroën were there. It was completely informal. We had a bit of... There was probably one journalist from each country or something. I can't remember. But we sat around a table with Loeb, who was spectacularly uncommunicative, answered our questions in like one or two words. I then got in the car. I found it really simple to drive. I found it really easy to drive. And within a few... Well, it wasn't... Yeah, I was about to say laps. It was a sort of course marked out around a stage. I felt I was completely on top of it. I was sliding it around all over the place, having a wonderful time, and thinking how very, very impressed everybody must have been by watching me skid this thing about. And then I got in the car with Loeb. We swapped seats. My idea had been that he would drive me first and show me how it was done, and then I'd drive the car, but they didn't think that was a good idea. They didn't think that me trying to go as fast as Sebastian Loeb could go was a great idea. So we did it the other way around, and then he drove me, and then I realised... I basically hadn't driven the car at all.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing these itty bitty little, ooh, look, I'm oversteering. And then he was there. I mean, just, it was, it, I mean, what I was doing wasn't even driving compared to what he was doing. And I can just remember, it's really difficult when you're in that situation. You will have been in that situation in the passenger seat, because there's a bit of you that's a journalist. Yeah, which thinks, I've got to come out of here with a story, so I've got to focus on what's going on. You don't know where to look, because you don't know where to look at his hands or his feet or out the window. There's a bit of you that is just the wild, rabid enthusiast, which is sitting there going, I can't believe I'm sitting next to Sebastian Loeb while he drives this thing as fast as I possibly can. And there's a bit of you that's absolutely bloody terrified. And all these things just run into each other. And it just becomes this incredibly... intense, bizarre experience. And what comes out at the other end are just a bunch of fragments. It's just snapshots of various experience. And you try to sort of glue them together in your head after the event to come up with some kind of narrative which will go to some small extent to explain to your readers what that experience was like. But sometimes you'll sit next to someone and you'll think, well, I could do that. And sometimes you'll sit next to someone and you'll think, well, I couldn't do that, but I understand what he's doing. And then there was Loeb. I couldn't understand what he was doing. I couldn't equate his inputs to what the car was doing. I couldn't, you know, his hands and his feet seemed to be doing different things to what the car was doing. And the way everything was coordinated so that it was almost like his hands and his feet were connected. And so he'd never make a movement of one without an appropriate correction. And, yeah, I mean, it was... and what was so great about it was I said to him after it was done, you know, how hard were you trying? Presumably not that hard with the journalist in the garden. You go, no, that's much harder than I'd normally drive because I know which way it goes. I know it's a bit inside out. So that was Loeb at absolute maximum attack. So I have that impression. Mm. I have that experience and no one can take that away from me. And the other thing, the thing that I remember most about it all, and there was a little camera, in the car pointing at us, and he'd been so taciturn and uncommunicative outside the car, but when we got in the car we had helmets on and we had intercoms, and he told me afterwards that all he could hear was me laughing. And you can, when you watch the film, which I've sadly lost now, but you can just see he starts off quite serious and by the end he is laughing so much just because all he could hear is me laughing. And then we had a really good chat, and you know, when it was just the two of us in the car, Senna was exactly the same. Senna in public was very locked down, gruff, offish, didn't want to talk to you. And then when it was the two of you alone, it was exactly the same with Loeb. He couldn't have been nicer. And we just had this silly experience together, which I will never forget. He probably forgot 30 seconds later. But in that time, you just see a completely different side of the bloke. And the car itself, it was so controllable. It was, you know, I'd driven a Rally Mark II Escort, which is meant to be the ultimate thing for sort of car control, isn't it? It's meant to be the most skiddable thing that there's ever been. A C4 Picasso WRC car was much, much easier to drive, to control, to skid about. It just made life, despite the fact it's a completely analog car, it was, you know, and no traction, no ABS, nothing to help you. It was just so good. And so supple and agile, it just made it easy. I suspect if you drove it like Loeb drove it, you might get a different set of experiences. But for me, it was one of those few competition cars that you get in straight away and drive it as fast as you possibly can and just have a ball. You're not sitting there thinking, oh my God, I'm going to crash it, or this is beyond me, or anything else. It's just fun. So lucky boy.
Wow. What a thing to get to do. That is spectacular. Yeah, and the piece Andrew wrote with some brilliant photographs is on the Intercooler app and website now, the-intercooler.com. If you aren't a subscriber, you can go and sign up and start your free trial for a month and go and see what the Intercooler is all about. Okay, we've got a listener question coming up. I hope we've sort of said something about Citroën over the last 50 minutes or so. I mean, the fact is we'd have to record hours and hours and hours to tell the full story of Citroën, wouldn't we? There just isn't the time. So I do hope we've said something. I know there are so many cars we haven't mentioned even, but there we go. We had to pick out the highlights.
Visa GTI. How do we get all the way here? How do we get through? What are we at? 45 minutes and not mention the Visa GTI.
Yeah.
There's one in the UK. There's one.
Really?
And I won it. Yeah, apparently so. Well, I think there are two, but one's Sorn. I think there's one with which is in use on UK road. Visa GTI. So want one of those.
There you go. At least you've mentioned it.
Yes.
So we've got a listener question coming up. Before I do that, I just want to say thank you to everybody who has rated and reviewed the podcast. I see you doing it. It's making a difference. Please keep doing it if you haven't done it already. Also, go and check out the Intercooler app and website, the-intercooler.com. We post what we think are really good articles every single day. It's stuff you won't read elsewhere. So go and have a look. The listener question comes from Stefan. And he says, many car reviewers seem to be more in favour of fast estates than fast saloons on the ground of having the best of both worlds. Great to drive, but also practical for everyday use. However, I almost never hear the counter-argument that saloons are inherently more rigid and therefore better to drive, and thus should be a better choice for car enthusiasts. He says he's got a BMW 330e Touring. It's his first estate. And he says it'll be his last because he can feel the flex in the body. It's an interesting point. Where do you stand on that? Because a saloon, by the nature of the body, should be stiffer.
Probably is.
Yeah.
But there won't be much in it.
I think it's a modern like that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you're comparing a coupe with a convertible, where it's absolutely night and day. And no, the point is a good one. It won't, insofar as the car won't be as stiff, so it probably won't be quite as dynamic. But, you know, you'd have to be driving pretty hard to be able to tell the difference. And to me, you know, these things, they're always a trade-off, aren't they? And to me, you know, the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages. I'd just much rather be able to, you know, put the seats down, have a huge load area, put my dog in the back if I want to, and you know, and I just love estate cars, and it saddens me that estate cars have largely been supplanted by, you know, by crossover SUVs and all this stuff, because they're just not as good. And I also think there's just something really cool about an estate car that drives really well. I just think there is something slightly, I don't know, it's not anti-establishment about them, but I just love the idea of a car that's really practical and also really fun. To me, that's the best of both worlds. And if I have to put up with a car which is, I don't know, 5% less structurally stiff, I've got over it.
So be it. There you go. Well, thank you, Stefan, for your question. Get your questions across, because it's a fun way to end each episode of the podcast. We'll do one again next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.